This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The Japanese government said North Korea fired projectiles toward its eastern sea on Wednesday, an apparent display of its expanding military capabilities ahead of a planned nuclear negotiations with the United States on Saturday. There were no reports of damage to Japanese vessels or aircraft traveling in the area. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe condemned the launches and said they violated UN resolutions against the North. Abe said the Japan National Security Council would discuss the situation and plan an appropriate response. A top GOP senator says the whistleblower at the heart of the U.S. Democrats' impeachment probe should be heard out and protected. AP correspondent Sagar Magani has this story.
Iowa's Chuck Grassley chairs the Senate Finance Committee and is a longtime whistleblower advocate, with some Republicans criticizing the whistleblower for relying in part on secondhand information. Grassley says it should not be rejected out of hand and that nobody should be making judgments or pronouncements without first hearing from the whistleblower. President Trump said yesterday he's trying to find out just who the whistleblower is. Grassley says the person's request for confidentiality should be respected. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Taiwan's armed forces deployed a floating bridge as part of their rescue efforts Wednesday, following the collapse of a bridge over a bay in eastern Taiwan a day earlier. A towering bridge collapsed Tuesday, sending a burning oil tanker truck falling onto boats in the water below. Six people, all foreigners, were missing and are believed to be trapped on one of the fishing boats. 10 people are being treated at hospitals, some with serious injuries. For details on more news, we invite you to join us at our website, that is voanews.com, or also on the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. China marked 70 years under communist rule Tuesday with a military parade, but in Hong Kong, demonstrators against Chinese interference held demonstrations that led to violent conflicts with police. Video footage indicated that one protester was shot in the chest by police. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
As Beijing marked the founding of the People's Republic with a display of military might, it was a tale of two cities in this country with two systems. Cat and mouse clashes spread across Hong Kong, with police firing tear gas and rubber bullets at petrol bomb-hurling protesters. Earlier, thousands had marched from Causeway Bay towards the government headquarters in Admiralty, defying a ban on a rally. Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement had vowed to hijack China's National Day to propel their protests further onto the international stage.
That was Reuters' David Doyle reporting. U.S. factory activity hit its lowest level in more than a decade as President Trump's trade wars take a toll on American and global manufacturing. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
The Institute for Supply Management, an association of purchasing managers, said its manufacturing index shrank for the second straight month. That was not great news for investors on Wall Street, as the reported slowdown in manufacturing added to existing fears of weakening global growth. The nearly 15-month trade dispute with China, along with tariffs on steel, aluminum, and other products, may have been intended to help U.S. manufacturers, but it appears to be having the opposite effect. Shelley Adler, Washington.
The Justice Department's Inspector General says the Drug Enforcement Administration was slow to respond to America's opioid crisis and failed to develop a national strategy to combat the problem. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The watchdog report finds that as opioid-related deaths began spiking after 2013, the DEA held back one of its key enforcement tools, suspending manufacturers, distributors, and others to keep drugs from being diverted. There were nearly 60 of those orders in 2011, and 4 years later, just five. The report also cites the DEA for raising the amount of oxycodone that could be produced in a single year by nearly 400%. The DEA is agreeing to some of the recommendations in the report, including mandating prescriptions be electronic, not handwritten, to cut down on fraud. West Virginia's Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, who sued the DEA, says this mismanagement contributed to the senseless deaths of many Americans. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
I'm Michael Brown, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Calls are getting louder for Liberian legislators to reduce their reportedly $15,000 per month allowances.
I believe that the salaries and other benefits we pay ourselves, we are unrealistically high, and we are leaving other critical sectors undone, and we're putting most of the money in our pockets.
As Senator Abraham Darius Dalum of Liberia, Tanzania begins deportation of Burundian refugees. The longtime chair of the Sudan Call Alliance resigns. We will have analysis. The East African Legislative Assembly calls for ratification of the Arms Trade Treaty, and public hospital doctors in Zimbabwe threaten to go on strike tomorrow, Thursday.
The constraint that the government is having is mobilizing enough foreign currency to be able to purchase equipment because of the poor performance of the economy.
Dr. Paulino Sikuzana is chairperson of the Health Services Board and Urbanism in Nigeria. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Calls are getting louder for Liberian legislators to reduce their reportedly $15,000 per month allowances and salaries. Members of the House of Representatives will hold a news conference today, Wednesday, to discuss issues including their salaries. Newly elected Senator Abraham Darius Dalum revealed last month that Liberian legislators receive $15,000 a month in accumulated benefits plus their Liberian $29,000 monthly salary. Senator Dalum says he will accept $5,000 U.S. dollars per month and return the rest to go towards development of his Montserrado County.
Well, I can say that we have a situation back home where the economy is poor, particularly in the toilet. And I feel strongly that it's time for national policy leaders to take measures that will commensurate with the current economic reality in the country. I believe that the salaries and other benefits we pay ourselves, we are unrealistically high, and we are leaving other critical sectors like education, health, agriculture, and infrastructure sectors. We are leaving them undone, and we're putting most of the money in our pockets. I think it's a good thing that we all see the need to make it a national policy decision to reduce the high salaries and benefits and allowances across the government, especially among those of all high-ranking officials. And so I took a decision to take only $5,000 out of the benefits and allowances that make up my income for the month, which is about a little over $15,000 in gross. So I opted for $5,000 every month. We can live with that sacrifice, put the rest of the money back in the sector for our people and our country.
Senator, we are hearing that the legislature has decided or has accepted to reduce the salaries. What do you know?
What I do know is that I'm hearing about some cuts. I think it's good news. I can't confirm it yet. The Liberian Senate has not taken seats of the budget for us to concur with the House of Representatives under Liberian law, like it is in any democracy. Anything that has to do with money issue, it starts with the House of Representatives. So the House will have to pass the budget, send it over to the Senate, and upon our review, we're hoping that the House have already done some consideration for salary and benefits cut considerably. And then we'll be making a case in the Liberian Senate if the House have done it.
Senator Dalum, you said that your accumulated benefits amounted to $15,000. What then is your salary?
The salary in Liberian dollar is $29,700 Liberian dollars. When you convert it into Liberian dollars, it's less than $200 a month. That's the basic salary. All of the other benefits and allowances like gasoline allowance, lease and rental allowance, and special allowance, huge in the U.S. dollar component, is all summing up to about $13,000 a month. It's crazy in my view. In this difficult time, our people need that money more in the hospitals, in the schools, and in other critical sectors.
Some of these legislators have been in office since almost 2005, receiving these huge salaries of which you talk. Why do you think it took so long and a person like you to highlight this?
Well, I being a Bauer-believing person, the Bauer tells me that there's time for everything. And I believe strongly in the ideology of President Barack Obama, who says one voice can change a room, and one room can change a state, and one state can change a nation, and a nation can change the world.
Senator Dillon, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jimmy, and we pray to God for the courage and wisdom to carry us through.
Abraham Darius Dillon is a member of the Liberian Senate representing Maserato County. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. Senior public hospital doctors in Zimbabwe have threatened to go on strike tomorrow, Thursday, if the government fails to meet their demands for better salaries and improved working conditions. In a statement issued Tuesday, the doctors attributed their decision to what they called appalling and disgraceful conditions of service, which they say have left them no opportunity but to openly declare their incapacitation. Dr. Paulinos Sikuzana is chairperson of the Health Services Board, which employs Zimbabwe's public hospital doctors.
You will be aware that the government has expedited their efforts of re-equipping hospitals with the assistance of the government of the United Arab Emirates as well as the government of India. A significant amount of equipment has been purchased. I think the constraint that the government is having is mobilizing enough foreign currency to be able to purchase equipment because of the poor performance of the economy.
The doctors are also complaining about their basic salaries. For example, a senior medical doctor is being paid a basic salary of less than RTGS, $500. And consultants are getting about $1,010. So what are you doing about this?
We have been benchmarking our salaries, trying to benchmark with salaries in the region, and we were making progress during the period when the economy was dollarized. For instance, if you looked at a junior doctor coming straight from university, we had reached a total package of about $2,200 at that time. But obviously, this has been significantly eroded with the fiscal crisis that the government is experiencing at the moment. It's really a whole of government issue. It cannot be resolved by the health sector on its own, but is in terms of the remuneration package of senior doctors. As you are aware, the prices of basic commodities have been increasing on a weekly, daily basis for everybody. So really the appeal is that while we try to negotiate, perhaps we appeal to the doctor's conscience to in the meanwhile look after the lives of patients, especially those that have no recourse to the private medical sector.
What will happen to hospitals, Dr. Sikuzana, if these doctors go on strike?
You will know that we have a policy which allows senior doctors to do private practice. We have given them permission to do private practice even during working hours. One would have thought that at least for them, that would have cushioned them more than the junior doctors. And they have rights of admission to bring their private patients to some of the theaters, for instance, in Parinyato, and charge them. So one has to take that into account. I think the issue of incapacitation, I think the way forward is dialogue and see how best we can resolve this. Mm-hmm. We are currently working on what we call specific health sector allowances to try and adjust. We are in dialogue with the Treasury. Once we get a position, we will bring that proposal to the bipartite negotiating panel, which we are proposing for Thursday.
Dr. Paulinos Sikuzana is the chairperson of the Health Services Board, which employs Zimbabwe's public hospital doctors. He spoke with Gabe Dube of Views Zimbabwe Service. Today's Wednesday, October 2nd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 14 and a half minutes past the hour. The Tanzanian government has begun the process of deporting Burundian refugees back to Burundi, but many refugees say they will not go back home unless they are forced to, because they say the political crisis that led to their flight from Burundi remains unresolved. Eugene Uwimana reports from Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
Tanzania says it has reached an agreement with Burundi to send back all Burundian refugees, saying Burundi is currently enjoying peace. The repatriation will be carried out in collaboration with the United Nations. According to the agreement, October 1st, yesterday, Tuesday, was the last day. But there was some uncertainty in the refugee community. Today, authorities have already released a list of over 1,000 refugees who have to be repatriated. We are all afraid and anxious because if names of people who don't want to return back home is displayed, it means that they will forcefully repatriate us. The refugees say they are concerned about returning to Burundi because fear persists in the country. I don't believe what authorities in Burundi say, that there is peace. What I fled fearing is still there. That system is still functioning like it used to. I will never get in a car saying I'm going back home. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees also feels the same way. It says political conditions in Burundi, which created the refugee crisis, is still not conducive to return to. The story is very different in Rwanda. Burundian refugees who do not live in camps are rejoicing the move by the Rwandan government to provide them with health insurance. This is a very good, important action that Rwanda does for us. We really thank them. Many of us could not afford health services, but with this card, we'll be treated as Rwandans and work for our development too. This policy by Rwanda falls within the UNHCR's policy to transform refugees into working and financially independent citizens. We are planning to do everything in our power to empower them, providing all necessary assistance to enable them to be healthier and free to do business and make their living without uniquely relying on humanitarian assistance, because the aid keep shrinking nowadays. Rwanda says it is accommodating over 140,000 refugees. The government, along with the UNHCR, will spend approximately 96 million Rwandan francs on refugees' health insurance. Tanzania hosts over 200,000 Burundian refugees. They all fled Burundi in 2015 when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced over a third term, which sparked political violence. Ajen Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
This week, Sadiq al-Mahdi, the longtime chairperson of the Sudan Call Alliance, resigned. On Monday, the alliance, which comprises opposition parties and rebel groups, accepted Mahdi's resignation. I asked Dr. Farah Aga, chair of the Blue Nile Forum, just what exactly is happening.
It means the Sudan Revolutionary Front is now leading new arrangement in the Sudan Call Alliance. Because the Sudan Revolutionary Front had a lot of agreements regarding the issue of the peace in Sudan, the sustainable peace. This is why they are now arranging their internal position so as to be ready to shift themselves to the fight of the good peace. First of all, the Sudan Revolutionary Front had an agreement with the FFC.
FFC, you are talking about the Forces for Freedom and Change.
Yes, Forces for Freedom and Change. And this agreement took place in Addis Ababa. It is supposed that agreement to be part of the constitutional declaration that declared between the Military Transitionary Council and the FFC. Unfortunately, that agreement faced a negative position from some members of the Freedom and Change, and those members, they were related to the Umma Party, the party which is headed by Sadiq al-Mahdi. And this was the main reason that made the Sudanese Revolutionary Front to fail in making that agreement piece of the constitutional declaration.
You say that the resignation of Sadiq al-Mahdi will mean that now the leadership of the Sudan Call will be taken over by the Sudanese Revolutionary Front. Are you saying that they have had some issue with the agreement that led to the transitional government?
First of all, the Sudanese Revolutionary Front, they are part of the Sudan Call, and also they are part of Freedom Force and Change, and they are part also of the transitional government. At the same time, they are leading negotiations with the transitional government in a different forum with an international monetary and regional to reach the good peace, the sustainable peace, and so on. Sadiq al-Mahdi, they are talking about the secular government and the secular arrangement. The Ummah Party is a party which has been built on a religion basis. This is why Sadiq al-Mahdi cannot defend this issue of the secular government. For the Sudanese Revolutionary Front and the armed groups, it is a major issue in the peace negotiations so as to reach the secular government because it is related.
Dr. Farah Aga is the chair of the Blue Nile Forum, an alliance of 14 political parties and three civil society organizations in Sudan. He was speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. The East African Legislative Assembly is calling on member states to ratify the Arms Trade Treaty and the Nairobi Protocol in order to control the illicit inflow of small arms in the region. This comes as 59% of the weapons in Africa are in the hands of civilians. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
According to the East African Legislative Assembly, sub-Saharan Africa has an estimated 30 million small arms and light weapons, of which 59% are in the hands of civilians and 38% are held by the government armed forces. Regional lawmakers warned that there are higher possibilities of weapons falling into the wrong hands and terrorist networks, since the East African community countries do not have cooperative and harmonized approaches in dealing with the problem of illicit flow of the firearms and light weapons. Matthias Kasamba is a lawmaker from Uganda.
You would go and you buy an ammunition, a rifle, as if you're buying bananas in the market. This is still happening in the communities across South Sudan, also in parts of Kenya. There is silent trading of ammunition, which we should work upon and ensure that it is curtailed in all the parts of the East African region.
According to the Regional Assembly, more than 7 million civilians out of the 416 million people possesses firearm. The Arms Trade Treaty and the Nairobi Protocol seeks to prevent and eradicate illicit trade and diversion of conventional arms. However, some lawmakers were skeptical about the ratification, arguing that there is conspiracy which drives the illegal arms trade. Jamari Muhirwa is a Burundi lawmaker.
We may sign different treaties, we may do ratifications, but never put an end to this challenge of illegal arms. Today we may ratify, all countries may ratify, but we still witness crisis within our countries. Why? Because there is outside political interference within African matters.
There are 39 million illegal firearms in the hands of civilians in Africa, according to the Regional Assembly, of which 7.8 million are in East Africa, the Horn, and the Great Lakes region. Olivier Nduhungirehe is the Rwandan Minister for East African Community Affairs and the Chairman of the Council of Ministers.
The Council is, of course, concerned by the proliferation of illicit small arms and light weapons, and the statistics that are contained in the report are concerning. And the Council will fast-track the relevant sectoral councils to resolve pending issues and have all relevant protocols completed for signature.
Despite only three East African community countries having signed the Arms Trade Treaty, member states are already state parties to the Nairobi Protocol, with the exception of South Sudan, a protocol that prevents, control, and aims on the reduction of small arms and light weapons in the Great Lakes region and the Horn of Africa. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
In Nigeria, where thousands of people living with albinism are constantly discriminated against, body shamed, stigmatized, or even killed, one albino is breaking the norm in the country's movie industry. His popularity is a glimmer of hope to many others, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
40-year-old Damilola Ogunti, popularly known by his stage name, The Goldfish, is an albino on a mission. As a teenager, he suffered intense discrimination, but Ogunsi says acting gave him a voice.
My journey started when I was a young boy. You know, I remember that the first thing my parents told me, that when I was 5 years old, they took me to a party, and one way or the other, while the party was going on, I think they dropped the mic and I found my way there, and I picked the mic and I started talking, and I think I entertained them a little bit.
Before his acting career started, Ogunsi worked as a merchant banker for nearly a decade. Now, he frequently appears on Nigerian movie screens, though Ogunsi says he's got even bigger dreams.
In my head, I'm James Bond, I'm Batman, I'm, you know, Iron Man. Those are the kind of roles I'm dreaming about playing, and I'm training myself, I'm working. I've started hitting the gym, starting to work out because trying to build my Hollywood body, because those are things that I want to do, those are places I want to go, and eventually start producing my own films.
Some 2 million Nigerians live with albinism, according to the Abuja-based Albino Foundation. Many face discrimination and marginalization on a daily basis. Although a few like Ogunsi have risen above the societal bias against their condition, the situation is serious, says Damian Evam of the Albino Foundation.
There are villages and communities where persons with albinism or children with albinism, once a mother delivers a child with albinism, they'll be killed. In Abuja here, there are about 60 communities in Abuja that is happening.
Albinism is the partial or complete absence of melanin production in the body. The condition increases the risk of skin cancer. The Albino Foundation was set up in 2006 to combat the stigma and discrimination. So far, some progress is being made, says Afam Kasim, spokesperson for the Albino Foundation.
The Albino Foundation was created to want to debunk the wrong information that persons have about persons with albinism, and to create an equal opportunity for every person with albinism to thrive in the society.
The government adopted a national policy on albinism in 2012 to help albinos enter the Nigerian mainstream and improve their representation in various sectors. As that effort continues, albinos like Ogunsi are getting ahead. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Calls are getting louder for Liberian legislators to reduce their reportedly $15,000 per month allowances and salaries. Members of the House of Representatives will hold a news conference today, Wednesday, to discuss issues including their salaries. Newly elected Senator Abraham Darius Dalen revealed last month that Liberian legislators receive $15,000 a month in accumulated benefits plus their Liberian $29,000 monthly salary. Senator Dalen says he will accept $5,000 per month and return the rest to go towards development of his Mosorado County. Senior public hospital doctors in Zimbabwe have threatened to go on strike tomorrow, Thursday, if the government fails to meet their demands for better salaries and improved working conditions. In a statement issued on Tuesday, the doctors attributed their decision to what they called appalling and disgraceful conditions of service, which they say have left them no option but to openly declare their incapacitation. The Tanzanian government has begun the process of deporting Burundian refugees back to Burundi, but many refugees say they will not go back home unless they are forced to, because they say the political crisis that led to their plight from Burundi remains unresolved. That is it for this Wednesday, October 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts. every hour on the top of each hour 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.